It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we continue our series of candidate interviews with Monica Moorhead, presidential nominee for the Workers' World Party.
First, the election is only 15 days away. Research shows millennials, made up of Americans who are 18 to 35 years old, are the least likely generation to turn out at the polls on November 8th.
Now, there's a lot of them. Pew Research Center says there are almost 70 million millennials in the U.S. That's about a third of the voting age population. But according to the U.S. Census Bureau, only 17% of voters in the 18 to 24 age range voted in 2014.
The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism just published an article about millennial voters and their impact on November's election. Dee Hall joins us now to talk about it. She's the managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
So let's start out with defining these millennials. What sets them apart from other generations socially and politically? How is this generation different?
Well, first of all, this is the youngest voting bloc. So there are certain aspects about this group that make them less likely to vote. One is mobility. They're moving for jobs. They're going off to school. They're having families. They're relocating for a variety of reasons. So that's one aspect. They're also the most diverse generation. About 44% identify themselves as non-white. And so those are two things that are different. They also tend to skew more independent. For example, when polled about the upcoming race, they're much more likely in the presidential race to go for a third party candidate rather than one of the two major party candidates.
Well, let's pick apart one of those items. They move around a lot. For the fact that they are movers, does that parlay into not showing up at the polls? Because registering to vote in every state is very different from state to state.
Right, and that's the key difference. So you've got the fact that they're mobile, which makes it more difficult. You have to change your registration, and if even if you're mobile within an area, you have to make sure that you're registered at the exact right address. Another aspect of that is as younger people, they would tend to be less attached to their community in ways that older people get to be attached. For example, they may not have children in school, so they may not be that familiar with the school district. They may not be that keyed into local politics on the city or county level. And so those are other things that can affect their desire or interest in voting.
Now, for the story, you spoke to a number of experts on millennials, but you also talk to millennials themselves. Did they echo what you're concluding as to why they're not showing up to vote?
I think one thing, you know, they've got a bad rap as millennials that they don't care about anybody but themselves, you know, the selfie generation. But they're interested, but they feel like political involvement is actually voting for them is an optional thing for some. They're more interested in being involved in the community and of issues that they care about. So I went to an event about a week ago or so with a bunch of millennials, mostly UW-Madison students and recent graduates. And, you know, they talked about many of them were very politically active, but were, you know, sort of reluctantly voting in this upcoming election.
And it's somewhat surprising to hear that they're less likely, you know, to vote than other generations, because anecdotally, they are passionate about issues. They're
right.
Issues oriented. They have we've seen their interest in politics. So why doesn't that clue into a vote?
Well, I think you've got these other factors that come into play. The event that I went to on October 12th actually was designed to try to get across the message that, hey, millennials, if you guys get together, you're as big as the baby boom generation. You're one third of the voting bloc. If you guys get together, you can move things. And one of the speakers, who described himself as an older millennial at age 31, suggested that think about organizing. You know, if you get together as a group, you can push the agenda whichever way you want it. And he noted the fact that Bernie Sanders almost won the Democratic primary nomination.
We're talking with Dee Hall. She's managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Voting booths themselves, I'm wondering, Dee, are they too old school? I wonder, you know, could millennials say, isn't there an app for that?
Sometimes there is an app for that. unfortunately, in our state, it's primarily showing up at the polls. You can also mail in your ballot. There are states where most of the balloting is done, you know, by online. I think Oregon is one state, and that I could imagine that would have great appeal. We seem to be moving in the other direction in Wisconsin, though. We seem to have, you know, more restrictions on how, you know, to how you register, when you can vote, some of which were thrown out by a federal judge, some of which remain in place. So I could imagine this might be considered old-fashioned by some people.
And does research suggest that millennials might be more likely to vote in 2016 than they were in 2014 or in any other election?
I'm not aware of anything that would signal that they would tend to vote more this election than other elections, except that there have been some anecdotal, you know, evidence, like Bernie Sanders, for example, you know, his appeal among very young people. That was a phenomenon. He brought a lot of people into the Democratic Party, or at least his wing of the Democratic Party, who really hadn't been active before. So there, it apparently is something that can happen, you know. This generation can be motivated to vote. How many of them have kind of gotten over feeling the burn, so to speak, and then have moved toward one of the other candidates? We'll find out in a couple weeks. But I will say that this group has been polled in terms of its political leanings, and about 44% of them say they're independents, which is a really high number. And so you can imagine that those folks, if they were to all head one direction or another, that they would definitely could sway the polls. You've also got more of them identifying then as Democrats than Republicans. But independent is the number one self-identification for millennials.
One other thing that popped out in your research, that millennials are a female-driven generation. Can you explain that?
Well, it's primarily, these are some experts who believe that because more women are going to college, more women are getting more highly trained for some more leadership positions. And as a result, women, and it's a fact that women tend to vote in a greater proportion than men. So you've got those two things going on. You've got more women, young women who are going to college than young men. And then you also have this larger propensity than to go out and vote.
And of course, millennials are not millennials for a day or a year. Do we have any idea what the future impact of millennial voters will be in the United States?
I think the idea is that they are already, and they will continue to be, a more tolerant generation than the older generations. That sort of makes sense if you think about all of our evolution. You know, baby boomers were once, you know, people that age too. And a lot of people predict that as millennials get older, they are going to make those attachments to community that make them more likely to vote, and they will make a larger impact as time goes on.
Dee, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
That was Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She joined us to talk about the center's recent look at how millennial voters will affect the election next month. You can find a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right now, we continue our series of candidate interviews in the run-up to Election Day.
There are 7 presidential candidates appearing on the ballot in Wisconsin. We've invited all of them to join us here on Central Time.
Monica Moorhead is one of the candidates you'll see on your ballots next month. She is the presidential nominee for the Workers' World Party. I talked to her late last week. Monica Moorhead, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to specific issues, what do you bring to this presidential campaign that we aren't seeing from the major party candidates?
Well, I think the main thing that we're bringing to this election campaign is the fact that, you know, we're raising the issues. We're raising real issues that Trump and Clinton are not raising. In other words, we feel that working people, poor people, people of color, that their views and their struggles are not getting the type of hearing that they should. That these elections, and another main reason why we run in these elections is really to expose, you know, the Democrats and Republicans as really two different sides of the same coin. That they really don't represent the interest of the majority of people in this country and also around the world, that they really represent the interest of big business, of corporate America, all for the sake of making profits. That is a facade to say that this is a democracy, at least for the majority. It's really a democracy for the rich. And so when we run in the elections, we have no illusions that we're going to win. In fact, we don't want to win. We want to use them as a platform to present really what's happening in this country and why it's important for people to take an independent stance against both the Democrats and Republicans, and also that only organizing, you know, mass protest and direct action and, you know, mobilizations will change things fundamentally for the better for the people.
What are some of the issues that you think should be being talked about in this campaign and action taken on, but they aren't?
Well, you know, when we decided to run in these elections, and we've been running, participating in the election since 1980, we always have to take a look at the political climate of that particular era or year. And so we decided to run two black candidates, myself and Lamont Lilly, really because we wanted to show our solidarity with the Black Lives Matter uprising. So we really feel that the struggle against police brutality, against police terror, which is all part of the growing racist repression in this country, was a very, very important issue, first and foremost. And also to show that it's not only the struggle against police terror and racial profiling, but it's also part and parcel of the struggle against white overall institutionalized white supremacy. And that issue, that struggle is tied into and is central to almost every issue in this society. So police terror is one thing. We're demanding reparations for not only black people but other people of color who have been super exploited for many, many decades and centuries and deserve some type of reparations because of that, some type of acknowledgement that racism has helped to build this country into the most imperialist country in the world, whether that's slavery or the theft of indigenous lands, the super exploitation of immigrants because of the theft of Mexico and other countries in south of the border. That's very important. And also demanding that all human needs be met, whether that's education, housing, health care, food, a healthy environment. These are all issues that capitalism cannot solve these problems, and capitalism cannot be reformed. And also to stop war and occupation around the world. So those are some of the main points of our 10-point program.
And the Workers World Party has described presidential elections as cosmetic changes, nothing that fundamentally changes things. You don't think the things you just mentioned will find redress through election politics?
No, absolutely not. And they never have. Every 4 years, since, you know, like over 200, almost 250 years ago, none of the issues that pertain to poor and working people have really, really been addressed, because you can't vote away racism. You can't vote away occupation. You can't vote away war or poverty or any of these issues, because all of these conditions are embedded, are rooted in the capitalist system. It has to be that way in order for the super rich to stay on top, which is a tiny minority, or the 1%, to rule over the 99% of the population. That's the only way that, you know, the Walmarts of the world and the big three auto corporations, the banks, Chase, Bank of America, etc., can stay in power. If they super exploit and instill the labor of the workers. So, no, capitalism cannot address these issues in a real way. Yes, sometimes there are reforms that are, you know, that are won, but that's really through the struggle. That's really through independent struggle, because the capitalists never give anything over to poor and working people on their own. They have to be forced. Those concessions have to be wrested from the capitalist system itself. And then when the struggle may die down, then all they try to do is take back those gains. And this has been, you know, we can prove this through many, many decades of struggle and progress in this country.
We're talking to Monica Moorhead, presidential candidate for the Workers World Party. Well, if not elections, then what? Do you see the need? You mentioned mass action. Do you hope that mass action promotes change within the current system or leads to the end of our current system of government?
Well, really, we're hoping that it leads to the current system of government. I mean, we're looking beyond these elections. Yes, we're participating in them because they're forced on us. But really, what we're projecting is what's going to happen after the elections. You know, let's take a moment to talk about the economic crisis. It's just going to get worse. The IMF came out with a report about this, that the world economy is, you know, they're projecting, you know, even a worse situation than what happened in 2007 and 2008, which we've never really recovered from. We really haven't, because this current phase of the capitalist crisis is in permanent crisis. There's no boom and bust cycle anymore. And so, and then people in this country are really, really worried about their economic situation. A poll by Marketplace just illustrated that a growing number of people in this country are really losing sleep over their economic situation. Close to 40% of those people, and that was taken back in 2015. So it's no wonder what's going to, you know, how people are going to feel, especially after these elections. So we're bracing for the worst. And so, again, it just shows that this system, it can't get itself out of this crisis. And when it tries to do that, it only bails out, you know, the capitalist institutions. It doesn't bail out the people. There's no bailout for the people. And so that's why we're saying that, you know, we really need to abolish the system. Listen, this country had a revolution back in 1776. You know, against the British, against, you know, this country being colonized by the British. And we say, well, we need a second phase of that to get rid of this system. Capitalism has run its in terms of being progressive, coming out of feudalism, it's run its course. It really has. We're fighting for socialism. We're fighting for an economic system, not a policy like Bernie Sanders was projecting. We're fighting for a new economic system that will meet human needs, not corporate greed. And it can become a reality in this country because all of the conditions are there. There's so much wealth in this country, $7 trillion economy, if not more. It's just in private hands. And we want the workers to run society the way it should be run to meet the needs of the people. The bosses are irrelevant. They're irrelevant. And so this is what we're fighting for in the future. But, you know, in the meantime, we want to keep organizing, uniting people, preaching independent struggle, protest, whatever it takes to really bring the system to a halt until people realize that they do have the power.
Briefly, as we wrap up, a lot of people hear socialism, and it's a four-letter word to them. As we wrap up, can you allay that concern?
Yes. Well, yes, absolutely. Ever since the end of the Second World War, the Cold War was just, you know, imposed on the people of this country more than any other country in the world. And that's because the Soviet Union was in existence. It was making progress with the people there. But, you know, things are changing. Things are changing, even after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 90s. And we have to thank Bernie Sanders for that, because he has helped to popularize socialism. It's not the type of socialism we're talking about, but it's not the boogeyman anymore. In fact, there are polls that have been taken that young people are more open. They have questions. in terms of socialism and what it means and what it can achieve. So we're not facing that same period of the 1950s, 1960s that really set back so many of the important struggles and movements in this country. So we're embracing that, and we want to move forward with that. And so if people are interested in voting for us, we are on the ballot in Wisconsin, and they can, you know, and because our campaign is a protest campaign. It's a protest campaign against these elections and against this system and all of its, you know, horrors and, you know, inhumane conditions that come along with it.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me. And people can go to workers.org/WWP for more information on our campaign.
That was Monica Moorhead, presidential candidate for the Workers' World Party. You can hear all of our candidate interviews at WPR.org and find more info about the candidates at WisconsinVote.org. And by the way, you can keep up on state politics. Catch up on all the latest in Wisconsin political news with the WPR Politics Podcast, available now. Join host John K. Wilson and Capitol reporting team Sean Johnson and Laurel White as they dive into the week's top stories. New episodes every Friday. Subscribe or listen at WPR.org/politics.
This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. 40 years ago, a novel and then a TV miniseries captured the attention of American culture. The novel was Roots. The author was Alex Haley, and the TV series drew over 100 million viewers to its final episode, telling the story of African-American heritage through the era of slavery.
All you have to do is tell me your name.
I'm Gunta Kinte,
son of a... Your name is Toby. Now tell me your name.
I'm Gunta Kinte.
That's not your name.
Our next guest tells the story behind the story, how Roots came to be, why it got such a huge response, and what it tells us about the way we think of the history of slavery.
Matthew Delmont is with us. He's a history professor at Arizona State University. His newest book is Making Roots, A Nation Captivated. Matthew, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, looking back 40 years, how much was the nation captivated by Roots?
It was really like nothing anyone had ever seen before on American television. There had been histories of slavery and histories of African-American history in the United States, but no one had ever seen this in mainstream culture. The book, when it came out, sold over 1 million copies almost immediately, and then when it broadcast in 1977, over 100 million people watched it. This was just before the advent of cable, so it reached American living rooms in ways that had just never been seen before. And what I think was important about it was the way in which it foregrounded African-American experiences, so making African-Americans the protagonists of the story, talking about things like the Middle Passage, things that a lot of people still had never heard about in their school education before, and bringing that to American audiences over 8 consecutive nights in a just sort of a phenomenal TV event package is one of the reasons that influenced people so greatly.
That bit that we just played of the lashing, it's a moment that stood out, but that was just a part of Roots, as you point out. This is just a few moments in an eight episode series. Can you talk us through the story that's told in Roots?
Yeah, so one of the things I think scholars and sort of popular audiences have overlooked about Roots is the fact that it was really about the emotions of African-American characters. So it traces Alex Haley's family. It's partly fact, partly fiction, but traces a family story over multiple generations. And I think that's what's so important, that it's not just about brutality. There are some horrific scenes in the series, but it's about understanding what it took for these generations of African-Americans to survive the capture in Africa, the transport to America via the Middle Passage, but then passing down these stories, passing down these legacies and histories, and really how these enslaved African-American characters interacted with each other and communicated that history and communicated these family stories over generations. I think that's something that people forget when they just focus on the whipping scene. And one kind of interesting thing that I didn't realize until I got into the research is, you know, that whipping scene actually isn't in the book. That was added to the TV series by a white screenwriter named Bill Blinn, because they wanted a way to sort of make this tension of Kunta Kinte trying to maintain his identity, make that resonate on screen. So just one of the sort of many fascinating things about what it took to translate this story from the page to the screen.
And you write in the book, Alex Haley, and you just mentioned, he was not the first person to tell the story of slavery in the United States, not the first African-American writer either. Why did the book Roots and the miniseries get so much attention where others had not?
I think one thing is, I hadn't realized this until I got into the research, that Alex Haley, he initially started this project in 1964. Initially, it was called Before This Anger. He initially planned to just focus on his hometown of Henning, Tennessee in the 1920s and 30s. As the project develops, he starts talking to his relatives, starts doing more research. It becomes a story about the history of slavery. But then he goes on a speaking tour. He's speaking all across the country from the late 1960s to the 70s in Wisconsin. He speaks at University of Wisconsin-Madison, at Marquette. Over a million people have already heard this story before the book cover comes out. I think that's one of the important things that helps to create this groundswell of interest in it, that people for over a decade are waiting to see when's the book going to come out, when's the TV series going to come out. So I think that's important. And then I think secondarily, it hits kind of an American zeitgeist. So it's just after the bicentennial. People are very interested in our nation's history. And it really presents it in a savvy way that was appealing to bring in black viewers, but also trying to not alienate or try to appeal to white viewers as well. David Wolper, who brought the series to ABC, was very explicit that if this became pegged as just a black history show, it was going to turn off white viewers and they weren't going to watch. So they cast prominent white celebrities like Ed Asner, got them in there very early in the series. And it was a very kind of savvy back and forth to try to reach the largest possible audience. And I'll say Alex Haley was always in favor of that. He was someone who wanted to bring the story, whether it was on the lecture circuit, whether it was in the book, or whether it was in the TV series, to the most people possible, both American audiences and then internationally as well.
Talking to Matthew Delmont, author of the book Making Roots, A Nation Captivated. And Matthew, you mentioned that this is partly based on his Alex Haley's personal story, his genealogy. There was research, but it was also fiction at the same time. Can you talk about the mix of fact and fiction and how the book and the TV series approach that?
Absolutely. So Alex Haley dubbed it faction, so a mix of fact and fiction. But it got kind of complicated when Doubleday and when ABC started to promote it. So Doubleday emphasized that it was nonfiction because they thought that would sell better. While Haley always said, you know, I was mixing fact and fiction, when Doubleday promotes it, they call it nonfiction. When ABC brings it to television, they start by saying this is based on a true story. So I think that has kind of clouded the memory of how the TV series was presented. From Haley's perspective, what he was a great storyteller, and he was really interested in drawing on whatever sources he could to make the most compelling and captivating story. So he did do quite a bit of research in the Gambia in West Africa, where he had identified as being the most likely place that his ancestors had come from. But he was also excited and willing to sort of take in whatever information fit the story he was trying to create. So I think this is where I'm a historian, and historians have gotten a little bit too hung up on is it really true or is it a story? I think we should embrace the fact that it was an amazing story and think that's why people responded so positively. And one thing that was interesting for me, sort of looking through these archives, is I could see where he was drawing on factual information and then where he was messing with things a little bit and where he was willing to sort of take fictional liberties to make the story more compelling. He kind of thought of it as a big puzzle, and he wanted the pieces to fit together in the best way possible. And I think that his skills as a storyteller is what I think made the story resonate so much. I think if he had stuck too close to the facts, this would be kind of an academic history that wouldn't have captured nearly the audience that it ended up capturing.
Part of his story is his genealogy, and I've got people in my family, a white family, that have done genealogy. It takes work, but a lot of that information is out there. For someone who has slaves in their ancestry, there was a conscious attempt to destroy any connection to that African heritage. So if somebody wanted to do that step-by-step reconstruction, it seems like it'd be really hard to do.
Exactly. I mean, it's important to remember this is before digitization of most records, census records. It's before DNA testing that he would be able to draw on. And for African Americans, there is a purposeful erasure of history. So that the part of the Middle Passage was a rupturing of histories, a rupturing of family stories. That's what made this so compelling to Alex Haley, and that's what made it so compelling to African Americans. The book itself became something like a Bible in African American households because it was not just Alex Haley's story, but it was a testament to the fact that you could tell African-American stories that would go back to Africa and really root African-Americans as fully American, that African-Americans had been in the country longer than most European-Americans have. That was a powerful message in the 1970s, and I think it's still a powerful message today.
You mentioned that in many ways the book and the TV miniseries were pitched in large part toward a white audience, and there was a moment, LeVar Burton, the star as a young Kunta Kinte in the Roots miniseries, he was almost rejected. There were objections that he looked too African. His lips looked too African. Can you talk about some of the thinking that went into the casting there?
Absolutely. So one of the things I think is important to recognize is the series never would have made it to television if it had not been pitched for white audiences. That was the nature of the television in the 1970s, and I think it's still the nature of broadcast television today. I think we see more on the cable networks, more of an appeal to African-American viewers, but I think it's important to sort of take the television miniseries for what it was, and David Wolper was always explicit that it had to reach a white audience. But it makes for this very uncomfortable sort of balancing act, that it's one of the most important African-American stories we have, but it's one that they had to feel like they felt like they had to foreground white characters to make it acceptable. And there were, as you note, strong concerns about the look of African-American characters. So it's very bizarre that you would want to cast someone who is meant to be captured from Africa and then worry about them having too African of features. I think what you can say in the story's benefit is that even though it was very much pitched to white audiences, it had more African-American acting talent than anything that had been seen in generations, and really almost anything that you see today. Actresses like Cicely Tyson and Maya Angelou, Leslie Uggams, actors like LeVar Burton and John Amos, that the number of African-American actors and the amount of screen time they have and the fully fleshed out characters, the three-dimensional characters you see, that's still a powerful testament to the show, even though they did shoehorn someone like Ed Asner in there in the first 7 minutes to make sure that white viewers wouldn't turn out. So the story itself is very much a balancing act of telling black history while also appealing to white viewers.
We're talking to Matthew Delmont. His new book is Making Roots, A Nation Captivated. He tells the story behind the story of the novel and the TV miniseries Roots.
You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Did you read the book when it came out, or did you watch the miniseries? What did you think of it at the time? Have you watched the remake that came out this year? Do you have questions about the book or the author Alex Haley or the TV miniseries? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to Matthew Delmont, author of Making Roots, A Nation Captivated. He tells the story of the book and the miniseries that brought the story of American slavery into popular culture.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you remember reading, watching, talking about Roots when it came out? Do you remember the sensation? What did you think of it at the time? Did you watch the remake that came out this year? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Brendan is with us in Madison. Brendan, hi.
Hi. So I grew up, I'd seen the LeVar Burton miniseries, but I didn't actually read Roots until I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Gambia. So it was actually extremely interesting for me. But I'll say one thing that really troubles me about Roots, because I do very much see the importance culturally of telling this story about, you know, African-Americans having this important history and this experience, was extremely important, affirming for African-Americans, and it still is. But I was just so troubled by just really page for page and the overall characterization of both Mandinka culture and Mandinka people as I read that while I was living and working with a Mandinka village. And it's something that I really struggle with, because I don't want to disavow that importance, but at the same time, that, as well as all the plagiarism charges and kind of other problems with the research Haley did, and also the effect on the kind of the use by the Gambian government, which is very oppressive in the Gambia, by the Roots of the Roots legacy, all kind of really problematize that. So that's something I just wanted to say. I really struggle with both the cultural value, but also all of the really problematic issues with the Gambian side of the book.
Brendan, thanks a lot for that call. And Matt, Brendan is not the first one to struggle with these issues, is he?
No, and I think he points to some things that are really fascinating about the book. And what I think is so captivating about this story is that it's a messy history, and that's what I loved about trying to put the story together. So focusing on the Gambia, one of the things that has gotten lost is Alex Healy, one of his primary sources for understanding what the Gambia was about was actually a Scottish explorer named Mungo Park, who was there in the 1700s. So thinking about how did Alex Healy come to write, in some ways, kind of an outdated version or sort of an ethnography of what was going on in the Gambia, it's because he was looking at someone who had been there in the 1700s. So I think the caller is on point in thinking about the way in which Haley's version of the Gambia was not exactly truthful. I think the other thing that is interesting is one of the reasons Haley received such a warm welcome in the Gambia is that they were a newly independent nation, and they saw his overtures there, his visits there, as being one way to increase tourism and to try to get more people to come visit the Gambia, bring particularly African-American heritage tourists. So when he goes there, the first time he visits, he explains what he's looking for. By the next time he comes there, they have a series of people who are more than eager to tell him the stories he wants to hear. And I think, again, this is where we see kind of a blurring of fact and fiction, that he does hear from someone who presents himself as an oral historian in the Gambia a story of Haley's family, clan, going back to Kunta Kente, but it's most likely the case that that person told him told Haley the story because he already knew what Haley wanted to hear. So there's a complex kind of interplay of who wanted to get what out of this interaction, who wanted to get what out of the story. I mean, I think Gambia had their own set of political interests in telling Haley the story he wanted to hear.
Brendan, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Nikita in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi, this is Nikita. Yeah, so I just wanted to say that I have seen the original Roots, and then I also saw the remake that came out. And I just wanted to make a comment about how when I was a little kid, my dad decided that we were going to make like a big family event out of it. And it was kind of a big deal for me because I'm from an interracial family. My mom is white and my dad is black. And so I don't know, like, it was life-changing for us to be able to see, like, the complex history of where we come from in America, you know, coming from both sides. Yeah, it just really impacted me, and it gave me a sense of pride of knowing, like, I come from somewhere, too.
Nikita, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Matt, is that something you think was a common response from people with African-American heritage in this country, a pride in knowing that there is this deep story that was as rich as anything else anyone else had?
Absolutely. And I think that's the importance of rooting this as an American story. I mean, people have criticized Roots for maybe presenting an immigrant version of African-American history, and I don't go along with that. I think the story of both the book and the TV series presents the Middle Passage in pretty excruciating detail. But then I think it roots that story as an American story. I think that's powerful for African-Americans to hear. It was at the time in the 1970s. I think it's still powerful today. And I think the caller's experience of watching this as a family event, I think that's something that I heard time and time again from just general viewers, but also from scholars who, you know, this was one of their first entry points into thinking about African-American history, that some of this work had been done, it was circulated in college classrooms, but it hadn't yet trickled down to high school curriculum or school curriculum. And so this was really a family experience, that they were allowed to stay past their bedtimes and see this together, and it encouraged people to talk about race and talk about slavery. And I think that's one of the strongest legacies of this, is that our nation has always struggled to reckon with this history, and I think a popular culture product that, whatever its flaws might be, can get people to talk in their churches, in bars, in classrooms and workplaces about these uncomfortable subjects in meaningful ways. I think that's a really powerful testament.
Nikita, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Matthew Delmont about his new book, Making Roots, A Nation Captivated. We got an email from Edie who says, as a young boy growing up in Ghana, our high school in 1983 went to the home of a wealthy businessman in the north of the country to watch the whole series over the course of a couple semesters. As a young boy of 13 years, I didn't grasp the full import of the series at the time. Looking back, he writes, it was important in shaping my understanding of African-American history. So it sounds like an immigrant to the United States now learned about African-American history before he came here from Roots, Matthew.
Yeah, it had a tremendous international footprint as well. So it aired in Germany, in Japan. There are great stories from China about people seeing connections between their own histories there and what was going on in Roots. It was actually banned in South Africa, and it had to be shown furtively. Its cultural influence can't be overstated. I think that's what's so powerful about the time in which it came out. It reached so many people in the United States, but then so many people internationally, and really presented a different vision of what American history could be about. And I think that's why I think television can be so powerful, that it just can succeed and can reach people in a way that books or academic histories can never do. And I think that I'm comfortable with the liberties that that Haley and ABC took in order to reach this much wider audience.
Well, and I've seen people hold Roots up as a counterpoint to the images of the slavery era that we get from Gone with the Wind, still watched today, and Birth of a Nation, less watched today, I think. Do you think this is an important counterpoint in that sense?
I do. One of the kind of crazy things to think about is before Roots became the most watched television series of all time, Gone with the Wind was actually the most watched thing on television of all time. It was aired over two nights by NBC in 1976. And sort of to think about that, this racist film from the 1930s being the most watched thing on television in 1976 gives you a sense of where people's heads were at. That's what Roots was trying to compete against. The quote that was said about Birth of a Nation by Woodrow Wilson, it's probably apocryphal, but it makes sense. He said it was like history written with lightning. And I think Roots was trying to compete at that scale. It was trying to present an epic vision of African-American history that would compete with something like Gone with the Wind and something like Birth of a Nation. And I think it's powerful and should be remembered in that regard.
So you've written this book. It's out this year. The remake of Roots also came out this year. What is it about now? Why are we looking back at Roots today? Is it suddenly culturally meaningful again after maybe fading a little bit?
I think so. I mean, I think, unfortunately, the racial landscape in our country, the amount of racism, the police shootings we have, many of these issues that were going on in the 60s and 70s that sparked Alex Haley to think about writing the story the first time are still with us in the present, and people are still trying to grapple with slavery as a foundational component of our nation, that we're a nation that has been built on this legacy of slavery, but we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to reckon with it. And I think the new version of Roots, I think it was well received because it gave people an opportunity to talk about this in a cultural form. And I think that's why it was remade. And I think that's why it was, for a cable production, was pretty well watched and pretty well received.
The original Roots got people talking for a while anyway. Do you see us having a sustained conversation about the legacy of slavery, segregation, the civil rights era, and beyond?
I hope so. I mean, that's my whole goal as a scholar and as a historian. But I think it takes work. I think one of the legacies of the first Roots is that it had this huge cultural moment in 1977, and then it really largely had faded by the late 70s or early 1980s. People went back to their business. They start making other TV miniseries about things like the Thornbirds. Things were not historically relevant in the same way Roots was. So I think these things provide openings. They provide openings to start conversations and then continue those conversations in informal and formal environments. And I think it encourages us to make connections between these cultural productions, these books and TV series, and then the things that are in our lives. I think the connections that I hope people will make are, what does it look like in terms of race and the history of slavery, history of racial discrimination in your own city, in your own place, in high schools and neighborhoods? And it doesn't have to go all the way back to the slavery era. I mean, we can look at federal mortgage redlining in the 1930s and 40s in the United States, and that's a through line or connection to better understand and reckon with these troubling histories of race in our country.
We'll leave it there for now. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Matthew Delmont. He's a professor of history at Arizona State University. We've been talking about his newest book. It's called Making Roots, A Nation Captivated. In the book, as we've been talking about, he looks at the novel and the TV miniseries Roots. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the topic, by the way. If you remember watching it, if you remember reading it, if you've watched it again lately, if you watched the remake, we'd love to hear what you think. You can head over to the Central Time Facebook page and share your thoughts there. A link to some information about the book there as well. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know your memories of Roots 4 decades later on the Central Time Facebook page.
Tap your heels together 3 times and think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place.
Those heels tapping together in The Wizard of Oz were on a famous pair of ruby slippers, and those slippers are in the news today.
Dorothy's red sequined slippers will be getting some TLC and a new display at the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C.
The Smithsonian passed its goal today, raising more than $300,000 on a Kickstarter campaign to fund the conservation of the slippers worn by Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz.
And I understand, you know, thousands of people donated dollars. Wondering how many Kansans donated money to that cause.
There is no place like that particular home. I'm wondering, I'm no expert in footwear preservation. $300,000, $150,000 per slipper does seem a bit steep, but I guess they're really trying to keep it out there for posterity.
Those sequins must be pricey. I don't know.
Well, they put the call out there, and it turns out a lot of people do have some heart. This is Central Time.
Just because I'm presuming that I could be kind of human if I only had a heart. I'd be tender, I'd be gentle, and awful sentimental regarding love and art. I'd be friends with the sparrows and the boy who shoots the